You know, it's, I'll tell you, it's Christmas right now. It's 6:45 p.m. San Francisco time, and it's Christmas, and I was gonna talk about the next moment in the title of my book. I was gonna talk about the word things. I've talked about reading, I've talked about the way, and I want to talk about things, as the title being Reading the Way of Things, and I will do that, but not right now. I want to talk about the human, the inhuman, and solitude and loneliness, and the relationship between these things. It's Christmas, and I always spend my Christmases alone. I say always. For many years, I spent my Christmases alone. And I always loved that. I always loved the fact that, I'm Jewish. I don't have to do the Christmas thing. I don't have to buy lots of presents. I don't have to go somewhere. I don't have obligations. I see people get very frenetic, and there's a kind of mania. But I don't say this pejoratively. I love Christmas. I love Christmas because it's a very different day. It's the only day in America, in the United States, where things are closed. You know, there's a different air about things. You know, emails don't come. All the push, crap, spam stops. The clients, emails stop. Work stops. And it's very hard to buy anything other than dumpling. On Christmas, and I love that. I love that capitalism stops for a day right before, of course Christmas is the great capitalist indulgence. We all know that. There's no great insight there. But I love that on the day everything stops, and I always enjoy that it's this other kind of day, and that people are running around with their fears and their anxieties and their joys and their delights and their anticipations, and dealing with family and all that stuff, and I've always been sort of spared that. I will say, growing up, there was a period there where we celebrated Christmas as my stepfather is not Jewish, and at some point in my life we introduced Christmas into our house, and I loved it. I loved it. I loved the tree. I loved the presents. I loved buying presents. I couldn't sleep the night before Christmas. Nice little Jewish boy who didn't have Christmas until he was like, seven. But I loved it. I wouldn't sleep, and I'd go downstairs and I'd smell the tree and I'd sit in front of it and wonder what all my presents were. And I loved buying presents making presents, whatever, for everyone in my family. The whole give and take thing was very, very joyous to me. I enjoyed that immensely. But, when I left my house, I took the luxury of saying, I don't have to do Christmas anymore. I'm a freaking Jew. I don't got to do this. And it was very liberating to me. And then Christmas became this great joy, this celebration of myself, the celebration of a kind of solitude. And I would have these great reckonings on Christmas and these great sort of joyous, solo festivities. And as I came to San Francisco, it often involved the buffalo. That sounds insane, but for people outside San Francisco, and even people in San Francisco who don't know, there is a buffalo paddock. There is a small herd of buffalo in the middle of Golden Gate Park, the big park in San Francisco. And I love these buffalo. You don't have to go through the zoo or anything. They're just there, and they're caged, of course. You can't touch them or pet them or anything. But I love this inhuman presence in the middle of the human. People jogging, people going about their human business. In the middle of it are these buffalo who have a very different relationship to the world, right? And to me and to us. It makes me think about many, many, many years ago, standing in front of the buffalo. I visit the buffalo often, but I was with my friend Eugene, my brilliant, beautiful friend Eugene, and we were just babbling to each other, all, in all frankness, we were probably stoned, and we were talking, talking, and talking. And there was a buffalo maybe 5 feet from us, if that. And we're just talking, we're just getting excited, talking about stuff, and we're right at the gate, right at the fence, and we're talking, and all of a sudden the buffalo goes, and like fake charges us and throws dust on us, you know? It's like, shut the fuck up. And I love that moment. I loved our human, you know, prattling on, and I actually love it. I it sounds pejorative or negative. I don't mean it that way. We're just going on our way, and the buffalo's like, just shut up, man. I can't go anywhere. I'm stuck here. Just be quiet. And to me, that's one of my favorite moments in life, and definitely one of my favorite moments in San Francisco, was this clear moment of exchange of the buffalo's frustration and, you know, he's had enough of us. So yeah, I spend my Christmases alone. And then, of course, I had a son. And then things got confusing. I'll say, when I was married without the son, you know, my wife and I would go, and we would do the same kind of things. We'd go to the movies. We'd get high and go to the beach. We'd do the kinds of things I would do. And then we had a kid, and we didn't really know what to do. And for the first couple of years, you know, we didn't tell him about Christmas. How would he know? He was born at the end of November. He's born basically Thanksgiving. You know, so for a few years there, he didn't know Christmas existed, and we didn't tell him. And then things go on, and we split up, and at some point we just split the duties, and she keeps him for Christmas. And I do Hanukkah. Not religious or anything like that, but it just seems like something I do. I don't know. The whole point being, I get Christmas back as this sort of solo experience, and it makes me think a lot about solitude. And solitude is something that I reckon a lot, and it's something that I enjoy. You know, I'm despite appearances, you know, I'm what I think people call an introvert these days. I can be quite affable and talkative, and I babble a mile a minute to everybody, but I need my peace. I need solitude. I need my time just to do my own thing. And, you know, part of how I've reckoned solitude is my participation in a certain inhuman becoming, and a certain idealized version of the human self within the universe. And it came first to me through Kierkegaard. I remember when I finished college, and the day I graduated college, I flew to Paris. And I had an apartment there for free, and I was all alone there, and I spent months just wandering Europe and Paris on my own. I came back, and I was living in my grandpa's apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and I'm reading Fear and Trembling, and Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling. And in this book, you know, it's really Kierkegaard's trying to reckon the intensity of Abraham marching up Mount Moriah with his son Isaac to kill him. And the fact that Abraham doesn't say anything to anybody. He is, in Kierkegaard's term, he is beyond the ethical. He's left the ethical, right? And that's the challenge of Abraham, is he's thrown down this sort of gauntlet in a way. He's thrown down this challenge to leave the ethical, right? To kill his own son, his only son, his son that he should never have had, right? He's big at birth. This is Sarah's in her hundreds, right? It's absurd. And he loves Isaac. There's no human sentiment to the killing. There's no justice. There's nothing ethical. There's no part of the social that drives Abraham to go and kill his son, Isaac. It's that God asks him to. And of course, at the last moment, God says, no, you don't have to do it. But Abraham was going to do it. And this for Kierkegaard, is sublime, approaches the unfathomable. He's like, what is this moment? What is this moment? He takes his son. He loves his son. And he marches up this hill. He goes on this whole trip. He says goodbye to his wife. And Kierkegaard imagines all the social obligations, all the social rituals. And the intensity of the moment is precisely that he is leaving the social. He is leaving the ethical. And what interests Kierkegaard, what interests me vis-a-vis Kierkegaard, is the relationship Abraham has towards the social and towards this other moment, towards what Kierkegaard talks about as a direct relationship to the infinite, right? The social, society, family, friends, the human, mediates our relationship to the infinite. We think about other things. We have these immediate concerns. Does she love me? Doesn't she love me? What will I eat? Will I get paid? What? All these things are quite temporal. And that's not to belittle them at all. It's simply to place them in context. In Kierkegaard's book, In Fear and Trembling. And what Abraham faces is taking his son, telling his wife, I'm going out. I'm taking my son. We're going on a trip. Knowing that he's going to kill his son, who he loves. And that's insane, right? I mean, that's Kierkegaard's reckoning in Fear and Trembling. I'm reading this book, I'm alone, and I'm sitting there on the Upper East Side, 77th Street in Manhattan, and I'm like, oh, holy shit, you know, like, that's the challenge, that's the intensity, that was the, you know, and Abraham, he walks up the mountain, he's going to kill his son, and he doesn't do anything, he doesn't have anxiety, he doesn't try to run away, he doesn't try to explain it away. He has a direct relationship with the infinite, which Kierkegaard claims is absurd, right? He calls it faith, and he says, you have faith on the strength of the absurd. You have faith on the strength of the absurd, and the absurd being that God asked me to kill my only son. And where does that leave Abraham vis-a-vis the social? And, you know, the refrain throughout Fear and Trembling is either Abraham is a murderer, you know, an attempted murderer, or he's the father of faith. Either there's a whole nother category that is outside the ethical, outside the social, in which Abraham stands face to face in an immediate relationship with the infinite, with God. And he's taken leave of the social, he's taken leave of the ethical laws and society and ethics. Or else he's a murderer, or else he's a lunatic. This made a huge impression on me. And really since then, and maybe my whole life, but that book really spoke to me. And it's not that it converted me, but it really set me on a trajectory of my own relationship to the social and to the ethical and to the infinite. You know, years later, I would really read Nietzsche. And I hadn't really read a lot of Nietzsche in college. I had, but in grad school, I read a lot. I read everything. I read everything Nietzsche wrote. Nietzsche talks, you know, about being on the mountaintop and can you breathe the air, right? You're alone on that mountaintop like an animal. And he's constantly comparing sort of these men, Zarathustra and the individual, the strong individual, the Übermensch, to the inhuman. And then later I would read Deleuze and Guattari, who talk a lot about the inhuman and participating in the inhuman. And over the years, I would develop a relationship with the sky and with the ocean and with the horizon. You know, I'm not a big nature boy in the California sense of, you know, people love to go to Yosemite and hiking and climbing and all that crap. That's not me. But I have a very intimate relationship to the sky and to the ocean. I wouldn't go in it, but it's seething power, its infinitude, its tumult resonates in me and with me and of me. And I've always gone to the ocean's edge and found an incredible seething vitality. I found peace, especially during times of great darkness and of human incompatibility. I've sought refuge in the sky and in the ocean and in the inhuman, and felt like my friends were the clouds, and I could reach into the flowing fog and sky and horizon and find my peace and find a kind of a vitality. And yet here I am. I am human, and I have a son, and a lot of my solitude, I've come to realize over the years, is premised on on the ability to say no to the social that wants me, right? So people, you want to come out? No, right? I would need my solitude. But I still had that query. I still had people who desired me. I don't just mean sexually or romantically. I just mean wanted my company. And in saying no, I felt like I was affirming my solitude. But of course, there was a tether there. Whether the tether involved actual people sitting in front of me, there was still a social tether. And I could romanticize myself on the mountaintop, romanticize myself as Abraham. But the fact is, I'm living within a sort of false solitude, a false Abraham, a false mountaintop. In which the human beckoned to me with desire, and I would turn away, and that turning away did not annul that desire, did not annul that tether. It's still there. I just chose not to grab it. And of course, that was a great luxury. And then, of course, over time, the requests stop coming. The tethers begin to wither and disappear. And one, me, I find myself more and more alone. Simply alone. Not just, you know, a man in his solitude, which sounds so romantic and poetic and philosophical. Sometimes it is that. But there is times at which, of course, I'm simply lonely, right? Because the fact is, I am human. I'm human. And part of being human is, you know, I can participate with the sky and the horizon. And that sky, man, just tonight, it's Christmas. I went out just after sunset to the ocean, and the sky was just bewilderingly beautiful. And I walked down the beach right to the ocean's edge, and the waves coming in, the water that looks so velvety, luscious, but beyond velvet, beyond anything I could know. And the sky, there was this big cloud formation and these red setting sun peeking through. And I felt this incredible life, but none of those things will rub my cheek. None of those things will hold my hand. With none of those things will I sit on my couch and watch, you know, Deadwood reruns together and giggle. With none of those things will I lie in bed and feel the warmth. None of those things will kiss down my chest and you know, none of those things will, can I kiss down their, it's chests. There will be no love making. And not to reduce the social to the sexual, but the sexual is such a critical, important element of the ethical and of the social, and especially to this horny Hebe, you know, and it's, it really sort of throws me back in on myself and into this sort of position, right, and this relationship sort of between the sort of ecstasy of solitude and the devastating loneliness of solitude. As I get older then, or maybe it's not progressive or linear, but as I'm at this juncture, I begin to rethink my sort of romance with solitude. And begin to see it more just as a constitutive element. Not just solitude, but the sort of the inhuman within the human. And this is something Deleuze and Guattari talk a lot about, and is implicit in Merleau-Ponty's Chiasmus, right? We take in the world, we fold that world into us, and we partake of becomings that exceed us, you know, desert becomings, rock becomings, ocean becomings, sky becomings. I am, from one perspective, as we all are, we're so much dust, we're so much earth dust, so much earth force. We are bundles of particles and gravity and magnetism. We are forces akin to space junk, if you will. And yet there's something human. We are human, and there's something distinct about human, about humanity, about being human. It involves, you know, memory, the way, the pathos, not just memory, I guess rocks have a kind of memory, but the sort of pathos of memory and of childhood in particular, of that kind of vulnerability and the sort of horrors and delusions and hallucinations and dreams and fears and joys of childhood that stay with us, that inhabit us as we grow older. One thing I really, really loved about the film Moonlight, which I think is an extraordinary and truly radical film, as the great film critic and my friend Rylan Knight says, you know, in that film, Barry Jenkins radicalizes kindness. But it's a kindness to me that is distinctly human. Nature is not kind. It's generous in its indifference. And it's that indifference and that generosity, that just letting me be, that the a human world, the asocial world affords me, that I find so welcoming, or so, not welcoming's the wrong word, so enticing. It's really where I find a lot of peace, and yet I am human. And I do desire, and I do get anxiety, and I do long for people who don't long for me back, or I get hurt, you know, emotionally hurt. I get distraught. People I love die, and I am sad. I grieve. I grieve in a way mountains don't grieve. I grieve in a way the ocean can't grieve, and it's what I love about the ocean, and it's why I go to the ocean. And yet I'm still human, and you know, in the past few years, I've read more sort of Taoism and explored a little bit about Buddhism, I suppose, really more Taoism. I don't really know the difference, but it really. There's a moment and there's an interpretation and a thread that runs through Taoism of a kind of inhuman becoming, a kind of becoming with the sky, with the clouds, with the infinity of the world.
And I was actually talking to a Buddhist sort of monk the other day. I hadn't seen him in a long time. I ran into him at the bar. So I don't know what kind of monk he is per se. And I was talking to him about some of these things. And I was saying, you know, there's a point, especially when it comes to things like grief, that I can feel and I understand the inevitability of death, the beauty of death, the cycle of death. That death is part of our human becoming, and it's beautiful. And at moments, I'm there with that idea and with that understanding. I have a certain ecstasy, no doubt. But sometimes I just get plain old fucking sad. Right? Sometimes I just plain old grieve. Sometimes I'm just this vulnerable mush of a human being. And a human being, right? A rock in some sense is never vulnerable. But a human being is. I think for me, in many ways, this is the challenge. Is sort of how to bear my humanity along with my inhumanity. I focus so much on the inhuman, on the non-social, on the romance of Abraham on the mountain, standing before God with no anxiety as he takes leave of the social in the most absolute and horrific way. But that still leaves me here sometimes, wanting company.